direct reflection towards decreasing planned downtime. Well, let's start at the top and start with task manager. What exactly is that?
There is, and the first three are one logical bundle. That's why the arrow shows like a solid bar connecting the three.
Okay.
Patch manager, one tool for patching installation, and proactive reactive merge are all separate customer benefits that would be achieved by one bundle of enhancements. The patch manager specifically is a tool we're looking at implementing, which would allow the person who selects the patches to be installed to be different from the person that actually does the patch installation. So at various companies, we can imagine that there is either one or more persons who would actually make the go decision on whether a patch should be installed. That wouldn't necessarily be the same person that is doing the actual patch installation. Typically, that would be an operator at on the night shift or something like that. So with Patch Manager, we want to separate those tasks so you can select which patches should be installed at one time and then later actually install them with a different person doing the actual installation.
So you're saying select. With PowerPatch right now, you don't have an option to select. It's either an all or nothing. You're saying now we can actually pick and choose which patches we want?
Right, that's one of the other main benefits of the patch manager is today, when you receive a PowerPatch bundle or a bundle of proactive patches, the AutoLink tool will look at that bundle of patches and see which of those patches qualify for installation on your system. But once it's decided on which ones qualify, you either install all of those or none of those. You have no control over selectively vetoing certain ones from that set to qualify.
Right.
With the patch manager, you could veto the installation of any patch that qualifies on your system that you don't want. Or actually, we're going to provide a capability with a safe option built in to force the installation of patches that don't qualify if there's a need basis, on an as-needed basis. The other important thing to note here is that today, the entire AutoLink tool runs offline with the users with the system unavailable to the users for use. And since the patch qualification is done by AutoLink, it is not done with the system available. When you're actually qualifying those patches to determine whether or not they can be installed, that's done with the system in an unavailable state. With the patch manager, you'll be able to do that patch qualification with the system available.
Right, so basically the system manager could actually pick and choose which patches he wants while the system is up and running, and then he can transfer that task over to an operator at night who actually can do the installation.
Right, that can be scheduled for a later time.
Right, how about the next one as far as the one tool for patch and installation? Which tool of many are you going to be using?
Well, that's a good point. Today, really, there are three tools or lines of tools that are used for patch and installation. There's AutoPatch, used primarily to install reactive patches, like when you're experiencing a problem, you receive a patch for that problem reactively. There's AutoLink, which is the primary tool for installing bundles of proactive patches used to avoid problems. And HP Install, whose main job today exists separately from the others because it can install new system upgrades from CD. What we're looking to do with one tool for patch installation is to combine all the benefits from all of these tools into a single tool, which is media independent, can install or patch, install new releases or patches from CD, DDS, or tape. So primary benefit being it's a single tool to learn and a single process to use, and it's completely media independent.
So you're basically taking the best features of all three of them and creating a new tool then.
Exactly. And besides that, end customer benefit of only having to learn and use one tool and being media independent, we also are providing a foundation for future patch installation improvements. Within the lab, we can focus engineering resources on only one tool instead of three.
I'm thinking from an end user or customer standpoint is that once you learn this new tool, you can now have that available for both system manager operator to do all types of installations, both patch and updates. So that's great. Now the third one could be reactive and proactive news.
Yeah, the third main customer benefit of that, of improvements in this area, is that we're merging the proactive and reactive patch processes into a single tool, as I've already commented. But not only are we merging them into one tool, but one step. Today, when you want to install a bundle of proactive patches, and then if you wanted to, at the same time, schedule the installation of some reactive patches, the operator would actually have to run AutoLink, qualify the patches, reboot the system, and update with the CSLT that was output from AutoLink. And then once the system was updated, have to run AutoPat again with the system unavailable, reboot and update again. So there are two reboots and two updates involved in the current process because the tools are not merged. It's not merged in one step. What we want to do is get rid of that whole back-end implemented that and allow in the single step for you to qualify the patches with the system available, then later install both proactive and reactive patches in a single reboot. That's eliminating one of the reboots for the system.
Great. Do we have any time exactly how much is going to be saved with that? Because knowing we're trying to track that planned downtime as far as patch and installation, do we know how much benefit customers are going to see?
Well, the main thing to keep in mind here is that the amount of time it takes to reboot a system varies from system to system. So it's just like EPA mileage estimates, your mileage may vary. Basically, it sort of scales with system size. Low-end systems do reboot faster than high-end systems with a lot of memory. So the bigger the system, the more time you save. A very important additional point here is that you also get improved system integrity. Today, when you receive a patch, a reactive patch, and install it using the AutoPat process, there's no qualification done on that patch to make sure that that patch should be installed on your system. It just wham, it forces it right on there. And so it is possible, theoretically, for patches to actually back out a newer version of code because there is no qualification done to make sure that the module you're replacing with the new one is not really newer than the one you're trying to put on.
Right.
Or other types of qualification, like whether or not the product actually exists on the system. So we believe there'll be improved system integrity for all types of patches because we will be doing the full qualification for proactive and reactive.
That's great. And knowing that these are under development, and from a customer standpoint, I would love to have these tools today. When do we expect these to be in customers' hands?
We're targeting to make a big splash at Interrex. So we're the September Interrex in Denver, we're planning to have the tools that I just mentioned available for customers to see them actually run and to be able to see the feature sets.
So it's a prototype or a demo that's going to be selling then?
Well, the tool is actually targeted for availability around that time frame. There will definitely be a demo available at Interrex, and potentially the actual tool product will be available around then also.
So in September time frame, that's great. Now, these other ones that are under investigation, you know, we run out of time. Can you pick one and expand on maybe multiple operating environments, what exactly that is? And I know we've also included it in the appendix to go into more detail, but if you could just take a minute on expand on one of them, that would be great.
Well, basically, multiple operating environments, you can best think of it as a way to put multiple versions of system software on your system in separate staging areas, so you can select which set of software you want to actually run. And both software components will actually be, the older version and the newer version would actually be on the system at the same time. You would just have a choice of which one you wanted to execute. And so that gives us, that basic technology gives us the ability to install, say, a patch into its own staging area without destroying the software or overwriting the software which was on the disk previously.
Mm-hmm.
So then at the time you rebooted the system, you could select either to boot up with the patched code or to boot up with the original code. Multiple operating environment technology allows you to do updates and patches in a non-destructive manner, so therefore it's much easier to recover if there is some sort of a problem.
That's what I was going to say, backup and recovery would be simple, then you would just switch over to that other staging area and go back to exactly the environment you were in prior to the patch installation.
And multiple operating environments basically typifies the strategy we're taking overall. Our focus in the patch solution is to decrease the pain associated with patching. We realize that no one has given us a magic wand and we can't wave it and make the need for patching to go away completely. There will always be some patches, but we believe we can make a big impact on overall customer satisfaction and decrease the planned downtime, especially by decreasing planned downtime is an example of how we want to take away the pain. MOE, or multiple operating environments, by making it more recoverable is another example of how we're trying to take the pain away from the patching process.
By knowing patches do exist, you're trying to ease the installation of them. That's great. How can customers now, I know you're saying under investigation, and I also see your next slide showing some back as far as feedback. How can customers best interact with you, Scott, and your team or within the lab to give them their feedback on your next steps as far as which one should be implemented?
Well, that entire list of patch solution components on page 22 in your slide packet is a dynamic list, and even the ones that are under development, we're still trying to determine the exact feature set that we're going to include in those, and the new ones we're trying to prioritize in terms of which ones we want to invest in. So what we're really looking for is some customer feedback to help us make those decisions and to pick the exact features to implement and the exact components to deliver that will deliver the maximum benefit to our customer base. So on page 26, basically what we're looking for is a partner, or multiple partners, and so we've included a fact sheet which you can send back with the information we need to be able to send you a follow-up survey or contact you directly if you do not have access to internet. then just go ahead and fax us that sheet. And if you do have internet access, you can send us a message at hp3kpatch@coop.hp.com. So those of you that do have access to the internet and email, that's the best way to get in touch with us.
Okay, within the internet, is that the comp.sys.hp.mpe area?
Well, the email user is hp3kpatch@coop.hp.com. You can send messages directly to that email user if you're familiar with internet and
okay.
have internet access. We will probably be posting some additional follow-up surveys and stuff like that to the comp.sys.hp.mpe group within the news.
Okay.
If you take a look at that fact sheet, I just wanted to point out that whenever you write a lab guide to a slide, we make a mistake. And we forgot to include the fax number on the return fax on the fact sheet. We put the phone number to contact you directly, but if you are going to send it back, and it is okay to contact you directly, make sure you put your voice phone number. And even if it's not okay to contact you back directly, we need the fax number so we can send you the return fax with the follow-up information.
Thanks, Scott. So I definitely can see your team has been busy at work today to ease the pain of doing patch installations, and I'm looking forward to seeing at Interact specifically what exactly the patch manager and one tool will look like at the HP 3000 booth. So thanks, Scott, and I'll turn it back over to Carl.
Thanks, Brenda and Scott. Danita, I think now we're ready to move into the question and answer portion of the program. I do want to make an announcement that if you're hearing this in the morning, Luna will be available for question and answers, but if you're hearing this in the afternoon, Luna from the mortgage brokerage firm of Margaret will not be available for that session. Okay, Danita?
Yes, Mr. Evans, would we like to do our polling questions at this time?
No, we won't have any polling questions today, Danita.
All right, very good. Then we'll go to the question and answer session. If you have a question for today, please press *1 on your touchtone phone. If at any time you'd like to withdraw your question, please press *#. Once again, if you do have a question for today, please press the *1 keys on your touchtone phone now. We do have a question from registration number 19. Registration number 19, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wondering if any time in the near future you would plan on being able to have online configuration changes doing on the fly without any downtime.
I can answer that question. This is Brenda Hess. We do have an investigation going on in the lab right now for online configuration of VPCs and printers and other devices. So that is definitely something we have resources in the lab that we'll be implementing to reduce downtime.
Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Once again, if you do have a question for today, please press *1 on your touchtone phone now. We'll take our next question from registration number 173. 173, go ahead with your question.
Yes, my question is, I've had some problems with the CPU. It keeps hanging up for some reason. We're not able to activate jobs, so I'm having to call into HP support so we can get our jobs running. And we're having to go through and do a cool start in order to activate the jobs. So we don't know what's happening. We seem to have enough disk space, but I don't know what the problem seems to be.
This is Harvey Skinner real quick. You say you've already called this into the response center?
Yes.
Okay, can I get your name and number real quick, and we'll try to call you outside of this.
Okay. My name is Michelle Lanier. My number is 813-635-8002.
Can you repeat the last part again?
Okay, it's 813-635-8002.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Let's take our next question from registration number 8. Registration number 8, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I have a question related to the high availability system discussed on page 11. I am recently trying to put together configuration for an order for a new HP 3000, and I found it very difficult to get information regarding which components need redundancy. Now, your slide on page 10 indicates that the disk subsystem it needs redundancy for to configure a high availability system, but I couldn't get any statistics from Hewlett-Packard about mean time between failure for specific components, and it seems to me it's quite possible that, for example, a power supply or a memory board or something is as likely to fail as a disk drive nowadays. And the second part of the question related to it is, if the disk subsystem is what is needed to be redundant, then also I had difficulty getting an answer regarding whether RAID or mirroring, RAID versus mirroring, and what the advantages and disadvantages were.
Okay, this is Brian Dean speaking, and those are two really good questions. The first one regarding whether or not to have your disk I/O system redundant really does come down to a statistical evaluation, and I think you're headed in the right direction the way you're looking at the problem. And it's directly related to how many gigabytes you have. If you have a system that is, fairly small number of gigabytes, I'd say under 10 or under 15, even possible, if you want to stretch it a little bit, the amount of failures you're going to have on those drives is going to be fairly low. But it's as you get more and more gigabytes, as you get up into the 20 to 30 and above that range, then those statistics start catching up to you. The statistics that we've seen for the entire disk I/O systems are approximately 3% per gigabyte annual failure rate, and that's for the entire subsystem. So that includes the card that's in the system, the cables, the disk mechanisms, the power supply for the disk drive. So that includes the entire subsystem. So if you just take that number and start multiplying it out, you'll see that when you get to 20 to 30 gigabytes, you'll get to a failure rate of once every possibly 2 years when you get pretty big, even down to once every year if you have enough gigabytes. So you really want to evaluate it that way. The second on RAID versus mirroring, there's really two major differentiations between the RAID with parity, and for people who aren't clear on what I'm talking about, the RAID drive is where we have multiple spindles in a single component, and those spindles have a parity drive that it gives it a high availability component to it. But there's one difference, and that's in availability, and that is with the RAID drives, you only have disk mechanism redundancy. So that's only one point of the 5 points of failure that you could have. With mirrored disk, you have the entire disk I/O subsystem, again, the card, the cables, the power supply, and the disk mechanism that's covered. And there's a statistical difference that the mirroring will give you better availability in the long run. There's also an issue with RAID versus mirroring on performance, and that the I/O, because you have multiple spindles in a single cabinet, the controller can possibly get overburdened on I/O because you have so much I/O trying to go to so much data within a single box. So as you spread out that I/O to independent mirrored spindles, your I/O rate will most likely not bottleneck. And then and another performance improvement is with mirrored disk, there's an algorithm that allows you to read on disk reads. The algorithm chooses the drive that will return the value the quickest. Okay, so on reads, you're going to get another performance improvement. On writes, you'll get a slight degradation, but most applications are enough read over write ratio that that you'll see an overall performance improvement. Does that answer all your questions?
The last question I had related to that is, you talked about user volumes for data partitioning. How does that help with this overall strategy? So, and you're answering my question, the first part is then, to configure a high availability system, you do need to focus on redundancy of the disk subsystem, is that correct?
Yes, I highly recommend that, especially in the large gigabyte configuration.
Okay, and then how does the user volume, the data partitioning help?
Yeah, that really is more of a recoverability feature of high availability rather than what I would call an avoidance strategy. If you're trying to avoid a failure, that's where you're going with redundancy. The user volumes is what allows you to recover faster. If you have 20 gigabytes of data and it's all in one single volume set and you lose one of those disk drives and you're forced into a reload, you have to reload all 20 gigabytes, which could have you down for, as you would probably understand, a significant period of time, maybe 15, 16 hours of reload time. Whereas if you partition the data into smaller units. Like, say, for example, if you had that same 20 gigabytes and you partitioned it into 5 gigabytes for system domain and 4 to 5 gigabytes per user volume, if you took a hit on one of those drives and had to do a reload, then you would only need to reload that one volume set, which would be about a quarter of the total reload time. And if it's a volume set that gets hit rather than a system volume set, the other volume sets can be up and running while you're reloading it. So it's really a recovery strategy.
And I just want to clarify, it's also been isolating it per application. So you're not impacting all of the users on the system, just those particular applications on that particular volume set. The rest of them are still up and running. We went into some more detail last month with an audio conference on consolidation that went into more detail about user volume sets, mirror disk versus the disk array. So, you know, for more detail, you can order the last month's audio conference on consolidation.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Once again, if you do have a question for today, please press star 1, and we'll take our next question from registration number 120.
Hello, this is for Brian Dean, and I only have two questions. The first one is, on page 6, the annualized system availability chart. I like that chart, and it's very useful, but I wonder if you could clarify the difference between recovery time to the colon prompt versus recovery time for the user prompt. And then I'll ask my second question later.
Okay. The recovery time to the colon prompt is basically, if you have a system failure, and let's say you have a software system failure, an OS abort, and you take a, so you, let's say that happens at 10 o'clock in the morning, and so that's the start of your downtime, and you, let's say you do a dump of the memory so that you have your, you know, so that you can do diagnostics on the problem, and then you reboot the system, and so let's say you get back up and running by 10:45 in terms of that now the system is giving you that colon prompt saying, okay, I'm ready and I'm recovered. So that's the recovery to the colon prompt. Then let's say, for example, your application is you're, you know, renting cars or something like that. There's a period of time where it takes you to restart those applications to get the user back up and running. And then when that user is ready to actually do business, then that's the recovery to the user prompt. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Brian. The second question I have, and I don't know if you can answer this. You may have already answered it, but I want to ask it again. How do you calculate, or how would I, as a user, calculate my downtime cost?
That's a good question that we get asked often. And it's very difficult, and I'll be honest with you, I want to spend more time in working with customers to really develop a more standard way of calculating. But I, of all the customers I've talked to, I haven't found anybody who calculates it in a very standard way. The only thing I can suggest is to, you might want to work with your accounting department, for one, and work with, if you're, I'm not sure what type of business you're in, but if you're in manufacturing, then you want to talk to your the user community, the management of the people who are actually doing the task that your software, if you will, is supporting. And that person, the people who are closest to what your business is doing for a business, can help you pull those numbers together. And I don't think it's one person in the company. It's really going and understanding from a lot of different perspectives. The one bit of advice I'd give you, though, is not to just focus on those direct costs that are most obvious to everybody. There's always, with most businesses, there's costs of downtime that are difficult to attach. And so if you can just get management to have a general agreement on what those dollars are, then you don't necessarily have to come up with an absolute figure.
Right. One of the things that we face here at the gas company is that on our network, we might have one portion of the network go down in one city, but it doesn't affect the entire network. In other words, we might be affecting, say, 20% of our entire user base, but not all of them. How would you approach calculating that kind of a cost?
Well, again, then I would just go to that 20%. That's a little more difficult because, one, you have to go to the 20% and you have to calculate their downtime for their outage of the system. But then if there's other parts of the company who are dependent on that 20% of the company that's down, if a delay of information is going from one part of the company to the other, then you have to go look and calculate those costs as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm sorry I'm not able to help you in more detail on that.
Well, that's okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's take our next question from registration number 3. Registration number 3, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about disk mirroring or using RAID technology on the system volume set. Is that possible?
Actually, you can use RAID on the system volume set. The only thing you've got to be careful with there, again, is the disk I.O. So you'd want to do a little bit of performance, maybe capacity planning type, to understand how many IOs you're forcing out to those system domain disks, because you don't want to really overburden those with the larger gigabyte RAID devices. A lot of environments can handle it fine. I'm not trying to scare everybody. In fact, probably most environments can handle it. But what we don't want is you to put in a large RAID device in the system main and then run into a problem. So my suggestion there would be start with the smaller, like the 2.7 gigabyte RAID devices in your system domain, and most people are okay with that. And we cannot mirror the system volume at this time, and we don't have plans in the immediate future to be able to do that. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Once again, I would like to remind everyone, if you have a question for today, just to press *1 on your touch-tone phone. We'll take our next question from registration number 35. Registration number 35, go ahead.
This is Terry Simpkins from Lucas Control Systems. I had a couple of questions for you. When you were calculating the cost basis for the coupled systems on page 13, did you assume that those two boxes are in the same room or in the same building? If not, how did you account for the redundant datacom infrastructure to keep them linked? Because obviously that could be a fairly major cost. And then secondly, question number 2, when you're arriving at a cost factor of 1.25, have you included the application software in your basis cost, or have you assumed that you've avoided an upgrade by spreading the load across two machines, which you talked to a little bit, because that number 1.25 seems to be just awfully low to me.
Yeah, that number will vary quite a bit. To answer your first question, the cost of the networking, I did make an assumption there, I believe with the cost that you were already running, you had a backbone, if you will, for the networking. I did calculate in the extra system networking cost, both hardware networking and software networking, but I did assume that you had access to a backbone. So that would definitely skew that figure a little bit. The second question, if I remember correctly, is the reproducing of the application environment. Yes, I am assuming there that you're getting a lot more, you're getting a lot of usage out of that secondary system with the application software, and so that you are avoiding a one large system. So let me restate that another way. If you have one big system, I'm looking at, say, for example, a 992-400, okay, and that would be what you would, you know, that's what your upgrade would look to. And if you split it out, you would go with, you know, a 992, 200, for example, and then a smaller system, not in the 992 class. So yeah, there was some. You have to make a lot of assumptions when you do this, and I've only gathered this data by talking to customers who have installed it, and that's about the best number I can come up with for now. But and I understand it is a little bit aggressive, but it's realistic in some real environments that I have seen.
Okay, thank you.
This concludes the first side of this cassette. Please turn the cassette over and begin again on side 2.